get started before it gets too late. My name is Deepa Olapalli, and I'm the Associate Director of the Seeger Center for Asian Studies and also run a program here called the Rising Powers Initiative. And it's a real delight for me to introduce our speaker today, partly because Neil Pidikone was a former student of mine, and I saw his evolution, if you will. We were just reminiscing before, and it turns out that he was a student a few more years ago than I actually, both of us, realized. Time flies. But Neil came to my course. That's a little story here, because he was an undergraduate. He was a senior, and I was teaching a graduate course for MA and PhD students, and normally I don't let undergraduates in. But Neil came to me and was pretty persistent. And I put him through the paces. He had to have a meeting, then I asked for things that he had written, and we had to have more discussions, and finally I was convinced that Neil could handle the graduate course, and I think I made the right decision. Neil has gone on to do lots of different things. You have his bio in front of you, but of course, most importantly, he's published a book, which I must say, you know, that's what many academics do full time, but I know that Neil has many other things that he does, so he's managed to pull this off while doing all those things, including being an accomplished musician, which many of you may or may not know about. But his book, Beyond South Asia, India's Strategic Evolution and the Reintegration of the Subcontinent, was published by Bloomsbury in last year. Got some good reviews, and today he's going to be taking off on that. He went on from GW, where he was an undergraduate, to do a master's, an MPA at Harvard Kennedy School. He was also a public service fellow there. He's also worked in India, I think for about 4 years. He was there in a number of very important think tanks and institutions, and he's published widely in a number of different journals, such as The Atlantic, The National Interest, and so forth. Neil is going to take a topic which I think is, and he's given a provocative title here, the question, could India's strategic competition with China mean peace with Pakistan? Now, normally, you know, one might think that you could conclude the opposite. You could make a case that, in fact, as the relations between the competition between India and China gets stiffer, that the link between China and Pakistan is going to get stronger and squeeze India out on this. So I think Neil, I'm going to be listening very carefully to what Neil has to say to show otherwise. I will take some of the credit for Neil's all the stuff that he says that is convincing, and anything that you don't agree with, that's I won't take the blame for that, being his former professor. So with that, Neil is going to talk for about 25-30 minutes, and then we have Professor Stephen Cohen from the Brookings Institution, senior fellow there, who will give a few minutes of commentary on that, and then we'll open it up. And with that, Neil, this floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Deepa. Right, like she was saying, this, I remember being here more than 10 years ago, literally in this room, attending one of these, and then going off to Deepa's class to read Steve's book. So this is a whole, you know, circle here. Many years, my own book, later, here we are. So, right, as Deepa had mentioned, the book is called Beyond South Asia, and the main focus is the expansion of India's strategic purview beyond the confines of the Indian subcontinent. And it's actually, I've been kind of lucky, because over the last year, the relatively new Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, has been helping me with my book tour. He's been going beyond South Asia himself. He recently wrapped up a visit to France, where he inks and deals with François Hollande. He welcomed Shinzo Abe, the Prime Minister of Japan, a couple months ago to do something similar. And he even went to a galaxy far, far away. By that I mean, when he was in New York, he spoke at a rally in Central Park, and I think that he confused Hugh Jackman with Harrison Ford and started quoting him some Star Wars. So clearly he's been making a lot of friends in a lot of different places around the world. But one of the most interesting friends that he seemed to have been making was Nawaz Sharif, the Prime Minister of Pakistan. Now, even before he was Prime Minister, Modi had invited Nawaz Sharif to his swearing-in ceremony in New Delhi. And so this was a Hindu nationalist leader of India inviting the head of state of Pakistan to one of his very first events as Prime Minister. And now, as we all know, India and Pakistan are basically a textbook case of political conflict in the modern world. So this seemed like a completely unprecedented move on an Indian leader's part. But in many ways, it was just sort of a throwback to Indian history. Let me explain that. So who here has been to South Asia? How about to New Delhi? Excellent. So you've probably been to here, Rashtrapati Bhavan, or the President's House, which is sort of the anchor for the seat of government. Most visitors that come to New Delhi see this place before they move on. But fewer visitors go to the Bagh-e-Bey Dil. Just a couple of yards away from here, tucked away in a little garden enclave, is the Bagh-e-Bey Dil, which is the mausoleum for the Indian-born Persian-language poet Abdul Qadir Bedil. Now, Bedil was a revolutionary poet in the 17th century. He was one of the first to combine Central Asian with South Asian themes, Muslim ideas with Hindu ideas, Turkic language constructs with Bengali ones, and really just revolutionized the language and the art form there. And it's interesting because even though he was born, bred, and celebrated in India, very few people in India these days even know that he existed. But his name and his verses still carry a tremendous amount of currency in Central Asia. In 2006, the president of Tajikistan, Imam Ali Rahmanov, had come to this very point and laid a plaque of respect at the spot. The Pakistani poetry scholars hold him up as one of the preeminent sources of Persian language poetry. The Iranians host annual international conferences on his poetic contributions. Even illiterate Afghans, they throw up their arms in delight when they hear some of Bedil's verses. Now, this love for Bedil really speaks to centuries of exchange between South and Central Asia. Because India was always bounded by the sea to the southeast and west, and the Himalayan mountains to the north, it was always Central Asia in its northwest that was India's gateway to the outside world. It was invaders and traders from Alexander the Great to Nadir Shah to Sufi Muslims and Silk Road merchants that always used these corridors of communication to access the region. And now AFPAC, the border we think of today, wasn't this militant abyss that it is today. It was a corridor of communication that facilitated tremendous amount of exchange. And it made this region, it made North India, one of the most rich parts of the entire world. But centuries later, after the British had quit India, the Indians had remembered that it was just they had left the region broken into more than seven parts. They had partitioned the entire region. So that severed all of those trade contacts that had been flourishing for centuries. Of course, there were more than seven countries. There was East Pakistan, West Pakistan, East Pakistan, which became Bangladesh, India, Nepal, Bhutan, Sri Lanka, and the Maldives, and a number of other princely states. But regardless of this, India had remembered, early Indian statesmen remembered, that it was just with a little foothold in the region that foreigners were able to take control of the entire subcontinent. So in the case of the Mughal Empire, they had come from the northwest, gained just a little foothold there before they took on the entire region. In the case of the British, they had just taken on Calcutta and Bengal in the east before colonizing the rest of the subcontinent. So India came up with a strategy, which has been known since as their Monroe Doctrine, to try and protect itself from the outside world. This consisted of two things. The first was to unite the region by denying the autonomous tendencies of its smaller neighbors. And the second thing was to disallow foreigners any presence in the region. Now, India's socialist economy would be one way of accomplishing this. Because with a closed economy, with a centralized economy, you could unite the region economically. And with a closed sort of import substitution-based economy, they would make sure that India wasn't a victim to the vagaries and the changes of foreign economies or companies. And India's, in the foreign policy realm, India's efforts to stay out of the emerging Cold War, not siding with either the Soviet Union or the US, resulted in the Non-Aligned Movement. And applied to South Asia, that meant that the US and other foreign powers would have no place in the region, which would be India's domain. Now, this may have worked well in theory, but unfortunately for India, Pakistan, the other large, autonomous, independent country that had emerged from partition, quickly rejected those ideas. Its very existence was to give autonomy to a large section of the subcontinent, namely the Muslims of the region. Quickly after partition, it developed strong strategic ties with the United States, joining two or three military treaties and alignments with the US, bringing Washington to the subcontinent. It quickly connected with China for the same reason. And over the ensuing decades, India and Pakistan fought more than four wars and dozens of skirmishes, based largely around the disputed region of Kashmir. Now, all of these things came to a head in 1971, when the East Pakistanis rose up in revolt against West Pakistan. India intervened and helped assist the creation of Bangladesh. In retaliation, the Pakistanis used the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan to develop a vast militant infrastructure to, in part, employ against India in the region. So this US and Saudi and, to a degree, Chinese-funded operation was meant to weaken the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, but it also had major effects on the Indian states of Punjab and Kashmir. Because this same militant infrastructure was sent over to the Indian states, and really just the two states were just aflame with conflict after years. And we're still seeing a lot of the fallout from that today in the AFPAC region. So as a result of all of this, India doubled down on its Monroe Doctrine. It reinvested in its military infrastructure and deployed it along the Pakistani border, along the Chinese border in Sri Lanka, throughout the region. Basically, the 20th century in South Asia ended in a deadlock. The Indians and Pakistanis were caught in this cycle of violence. They hardly traded. They didn't cooperate over shared water resources. And that was why Bill Clinton gave the region the moniker, the most dangerous place in the world. In 1991, though, India experienced a financial crisis, and it responded by liberalizing its markets and opening them up for foreign investment and deregulating a lot of the license raj, which is what the system of regulation was called. And the effects of that over the coming decades were to make Indian growth skyrocket. Throughout the 2000s, the growth rate hit 7 and even 9%. And to fuel that construction, Indian firms started to seek to go abroad, seeking both new markets and new sources of energy and natural resources. But at the same time, China's growth was also expanding, even faster than India's had been. China became the world's basically main producer. And to fuel the tremendous amount of growth and construction that came out of that, the Chinese needed access to Middle Eastern and Central Asian resources, and also to control those routes to access them. So for the very first time in China's history, it was able to invest enough money to develop a full navy. And it's been sort of, China's been going around much of Asia, developing strategic partnerships that many folks have taken to calling its string of pearls. For example, China developed the Hainan Island port just to sort of hem off American influence in the South China Sea. It's seeking to develop a canal across Thailand and a railway and road across Myanmar so that it can access the Indian Ocean with more ease. It's developed some of the only natural gas pipelines that have actually come to fruition in Central Asia to import Kazakh and Turkmen natural gas. And probably of greatest concern to India is that it's developing a naval base at Sri Lanka, right at Hambantota Port, right smack in the middle of the Indian Ocean, to extend its influence in that region. And all of this is while it's building up its military across the Tibetan border, just north of India. So as you can imagine, the Indians have become extremely, extremely scared about this. But as a result of these efforts to manage and balance China's rise, while also seeking new markets and sources of energy, India started to move beyond South Asia. So in the early 90s, it articulated its Look East policy, in which it would reconnect with the countries of East and Southeast Asia. Singapore became the largest source of foreign investment. Trade ties and military connections with Japan and Australia strengthened. It even developed roadway infrastructure across Burma. And probably the most interesting was that India even has been working to strengthen Vietnam's military. Because Vietnam had fought a bitter war with China in 1979, the Vietnamese have been very concerned about China's rise in the region, and so they've been happy to cooperate with the Indians, the Chinese, and even the Americans, despite the history there. India has also started to look west, strengthening its trade relations in energy resources and in services and, of course, labor with the countries of the Middle East and Africa. And it's also looked north and back to Central Asia to develop sort of a new Silk Road across the region. In tandem with, it signed a number of energy deals with Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and Kazakhstan. It's developed an Air Force base in Tajikistan. It's invested more than $2 billion in Afghanistan, and that includes constructing a new parliament building, training the police and military forces, and even developing a new vital highway from Zaranj on the border with Iran to Dalaran. But probably the most important thing that India has done in Central Asia is to work with Iran to build a road from the Chabahar port in eastern Iran all the way up to the Zaranj border with Afghanistan. Now, India developed this road and burgeoning rail line mostly with the intention of accessing its investments in the region. But it's also had the effect of enabling Afghanistan to have an entirely new way to access the sea. Because for centuries, Afghanistan has been entirely dependent on Pakistan for access to trade and to the rest of the world. And this has been bad for Afghanistan, it's been bad for America and the West, because we've had to depend on the Pakistani military for that access. And it's even been bad for the Pakistanis, because they've been feeling a lot of the fallout from these regional dynamics. But this new road and railway, by opening up Central Asia in a new way, could change all of those dynamics dramatically. But of course, to access all of these new investments and new areas of interest, India has also been expanding its navy from a brown water navy to a blue water one, one that can access distant shores much more easily. And to push back against China's growing presence in the region, it's developing a port at Port Blair, right there in the Andaman Islands, to try and hem China's growth in the region. You see, China is largely dependent on the Strait of Malacca, right there at Singapore and Malaysia, for a large percent of its trade, and particularly natural resources. But with an Indian naval presence right there at the Andaman Islands, it's able to interdict shipments there in case of any sort of conflict. And this is largely why the United States has been interested in India over the last few years. And it's why, in January, Narendra Modi and President Obama developed this really strong bromance when he invited him to New Delhi. Because America's been seeking to develop that same naval power in India to help the United States with its own efforts to balance against China. So, through all of this, we're seeing that in an effort to access new markets, new sources of energy, and also to balance against China, India is moving beyond South Asia for its strategic needs. So what does that mean for India's relationship with Pakistan? As we said in the beginning, and as we've seen, this is a textbook case of political conflict in the modern world. And yet, India's own goals within the region are evolving. They're changing. India no longer wants to keep the region insulated and isolated from the rest of the world. It's seeking three new things. It's seeking a more stable reason for investment. It's seeking to actually access those new markets across those same corridors of communication that enabled trade hundreds of years ago. And of course, it's seeking to minimize China's influence in the region. So all of this coming together is making India far more conciliatory to its South Asian neighbors, and that includes Pakistan. For example, much of the Indian Navy is being moved from its western coast over to the eastern side of the Bay of Bengal in anticipation of any sort of conflict with China. To a lesser degree and at a much slower scale, the same thing is happening with its land forces that are moving slowly from the Pakistani border to the northern border of China. And India is also seeking to access those same markets that we were talking about before. And as a result, the two countries have extended most favored nation status to one another. So as tangible products of this, we're seeing that India and Pakistan came to an agreement to trade for India to sell natural gas from its refineries at Gujarat on the western coast to Pakistan. And India is even, and this could be a game changer here, is restructuring its energy and electricity generation infrastructure in Punjab precisely so that it can sell electricity and provide it to the Pakistani provinces of Punjab, northwestern frontier, and Kashmir. And at the same time, Pakistan itself is increasingly more concerned with domestic terrorism, and even with fears of the United States than it is with India. Because during the bin Laden raid in 2011, it was proven that the United States could and would brazenly infiltrate Pakistani territory if it needed to. That was something the Indians hadn't done in years and years. And so to sort of manage that conflict on its western border and domestically, Pakistan has also sought to minimize tensions to a degree with India. Now, I'm not saying much as the hyperbolic title of this presentation would imply, that peace or friendship will really break out anytime in the near future. But what I am saying is that with India focused on its east and its movement beyond South Asia, and with Pakistan focused on its west and developments within its country, the two countries can finally ignore each other. And that policy of mutual avoidance is opening up a political space for more discussion and more dialogue on things like trade that can help to normalize relationships between and infrastructure between the two countries. Infrastructure can sort of reintegrate the region and bring it back to its pre-partition days. So road, rail, electricity grids, and even pipelines are starting to retrace the Grand Trunk Road from Kabul in Afghanistan all the way to Dhaka in Bangladesh. Products from factories from producers in one country are being manufactured in factories from another. The exchange of goods as banal as onions and tea are slowly, even services and labor over the long term are being exchanged over increasingly porous borders. And even things like water management is slowly, ever so slowly being addressed, could be addressed. Now again, I'm not saying that full brotherly love is going to break out any moment. That'll require a lot more time, a lot more political space. But Indian statesmen have always spoken of enhanced trade and enhanced connectivity, allowing travelers to have breakfast in Indian Amritsar, lunch in Pakistani Lahore, and dinner in Kabul in Afghanistan. Maybe they ought to bring along a copy of Baydil's poetry to make that journey just a little sweeter. Thank you.
Steve, could you, and also I neglected to mention that Neil's book is available for purchase over there, so can grab it.
I'll just say a few words and certainly comment positively on Neil's presentation. I haven't had a chance to read the book. We had, I live in the Watergate, we had an incident the other day, like a garage collapsed, and so I've been unable to get to it. But let me say I'm in broad agreement with your argument. I think that what we're doing now is seeing a new generation of Indian strategists or thinkers, especially younger people, but also older people, who go back and think of the Mughal Empire. The Mughals created South Asia, he called it Hindustan. And the British East India Company simply ruled in the name of the Mughals, literally. They collected taxes on behalf of the Mughal Empire. Eventually they became the British Raj. So I think what you're seeing is the recreation of that entity. What happened at the end of World War II was India was divided and China was united. China became one country by 49. India became two countries and three countries. It may have taken this long to sort of before, and I think the presence of nuclear weapons before people began to think of other alternatives. India used to be the most integrated region in the world under the British, and it's now the least integrated region in the world according to the World Bank, and the third most violent region in the world. That could happen, in a sense, the introduction of nuclear weapons provide the umbrella under which India, Pakistan, China can normalize their relationship. I won't become friends, but at least be less hostile. Well, this will permit people to trade, move back and forth. I wrote a book 2 years ago and I was very skeptical. I said the subtitle was shooting towards a century, 1947, 2047. I think that, but the end of that book did argue with the argument you made also, that China's presence in Afghanistan may change it. China may become an Afghan power replacing us and therefore may exercise its influence over Pakistan. And the Chinese are deeply concerned about Islamic radicalism in Pakistan, as is India, as is the United States. So that could be the common basis. Most Pakistanis, all Indians, some Chinese, some Americans, having a shared interest in combating the extremist violence. If that happened, if the Chinese played their cards right, if the Indians responded properly, in a sense, you might have a normal relationship. Now, a normal relationship between major powers does not mean peace. It means competition all over the place, little wars, trade competitions, and so forth, involvement in each other's domestic politics occasionally. But it doesn't mean escalation to the total level. And I think that would be one, but I think very favorable prospect. I agree with much of your argument. Yeah, good. Thank you.
All right, so I think we'll open up to questions. And I may start by making a few points on Neil. I suppose I would say that, Neil, your argument seems to be somewhat aspirational in the sense that when you look at the Indo-Pak relationship, the potential that you see for further improvement is fairly slight in the sense of actual evidence on the ground. Clearly there are new generation of strategic thinkers on, at least on the Indian side, and to some extent on the Pakistani side as well. But if you're looking to India to make this overture, because that's what it sounds like, that's where the push is going to come from. This is not something totally new, of course. You know, we have had under Gujarat in the 1990s, the Good Neighborhood Policy, Vajpayee in 2002 onwards as well. What I also would see as India going beyond South Asia is, at least in the beginning, in the early 1990s, I think it started as a kind of way to escape South Asia, because it did seem as if it was getting tied down, and therefore it kind of was ignoring and trying to go beyond, not just South Asia, but Pakistan in particular, keeping it down. So the question now, really, in a sense, is has the new economic infrastructure and the new thinking and the globalization, has that changed the incentive structure sufficiently for the region to think in a different way, break out of that? And I think there is potential for that. So I think it's good that you pointed it out. As I say, I think it's quite aspirational, but it's good that the next generation is actually pointing these things out and thinking outside the box. So we're opening it up to the audience. So any thoughts that you have? And when you, if you would please identify yourself and your affiliation, that would be good. Here we have a mic back there. Neil hasn't answered all the questions. There's a lot of.
Sure.
Yeah.
Thanks. My name is Leon Firth, and I belong to the Elliott School faculty, and I'm proud to recognize a former student in Neil. You haven't mentioned anything about the impact of natural resources, water, climate change on the dynamics. The description of what's moving the relationship between these countries is sort of based on an assessment of very traditional forces. Here comes something very powerful, entirely new. What do you make of that?
There are a good two chapters in the book.
Which you
should can pick up in the corner. But in a nutshell, I absolutely agree with you. I would highlight just two points with regard to water resources. One is that many of the rivers that supply most of South Asia, whether it's India, Nepal, Pakistan, Bangladesh, all originate in China. And the effects of that, of Chinese control over the sources of those water, are a tremendous lever that it has in one sense. And I think that more than any military confrontation between even in India and China, over any other political or strategic issue, I think water would be the biggest. That said, in one sense, there has been movement by transnational networks of South Asians, of Indians, Pakistanis, Nepalis, and Bangladeshis, to use that shared, for lack of a better word, victimhood. The fact that they're all lower riparians of Chinese water, to come together and as a voice for against is a strong word, but to bring that common voice to China and say, look, whenever you dam a river in your part of the world, in Tibet, it affects us. So at the very least, there needs to be better communication about that. And one proposal that came out of that was a Himalayan Rivers Commission or Himalayan Waters Commission that is at least being discussed. And the fact that this is changing the dynamic across the South Asian countries is very powerful. That said, there's still a lot of work to be done in that space, particularly concerning China. The second source that I'd highlight is the Indus River, which starts largely in China, but really gets underway in India and then goes on to supply most of eastern Pakistan. Now, this has been a political hot button for more than 50 years. And yet, the Indus Water Treaty was actually one of the great successes of cooperation between India and Pakistan back in 1960. So, in a sense, the fact that that's held through, even through wars, there was, in 1999, during the Kargil War, the Indian government had contemplated cutting off water supplies, but they didn't actually go through with it. There still has been a lot of mostly media and political jockeying over, you know, what's particularly Pakistanis worrying about, whether run-of-the-river dams in India will affect their water flow. And that's definitely going to be a huge issue. But one thing that, to kind of flip it and say, and look at sort of the more optimistic side, is that when trade of water-intensive goods is enabled over the Indian-Pakistani border, a lot of the concern over those water supplies could potentially be mitigated. This is exactly what happened to help the relationship between Egypt and Sudan over the Nile River waters. Because the primary reason the Pakistanis are concerned about their water supply is not drinking water, it's not even industrial use, it's agriculture. Partly for employment, but largely for just agricultural products that come as a result of those. And a lot of work has to be done on the Pakistani side domestically in terms of managing the water, because groundwater aquifers within Pakistan are slowly drying up. But if there's greater trade of a lot of those water-intensive goods, like onions, for example, a little bit of that concern over the final product. So instead of trading water, you're trading the products of water.
Hello, good afternoon. Neil, my name is Zaman. I'm from Pakistan Embassy. I'm a diplomat based in Washington, and in my previous stint, I was in Beijing for 3 years. Thank you very much for your presentation, and congratulations on your book. I had a few points. China and India's rise, the rising economies, to me, is nothing unusual or nothing new in the world. Until a few centuries ago, Chinese and Indian economies were the largest economies in the world. And to the best of my knowledge of history, the relationship between China and India then was pretty much non-existent or not adversarial, so to speak. So as they rise again, why does it have to become competitive, bordering on adversarial? And what is in India that makes Indians believe that China is an adversary? To give you some examples, China's trade with Pakistan is hardly $15 billion. China's trade with India is $70 billion. Of course, there's capacity. India is a large country. Chinese and Indian armies conduct joint exercises. They have a regular border dialogue. Chinese high-level visits to India match or even outmatch Pakistan with their high-level visits to Pakistan. Chinese and Indian leaders have more opportunities to interact in world forums like BRICS, APAC, G20, and the place than they meet with Pakistanis. So is it really that adversarial as it made out to be? And if it is, why does India look at China in that sense? This is one. Secondly, how would you compare China and India in terms of their rising power behavior as a rising power? China has tried to integrate the regions on its periphery, like Vietnam, Russia, Kazakhstan, Central Asia. It has invested in economic connectivity. Is India wanting to do that? Do you see signs of that? And finally, your pitch for India making a conciliatory outreach to Pakistan is really the need of the time. You need to make this presentation in New Delhi.
My next stop. thank you and welcome. On the first question of the conflicting relations, why, given the history of non-antagonism between the two countries, why should it be any different today? To take that same comparison, take the same contrast, China as defined then was physically and politically completely different than what it is now. Probably the most important difference is the presence of Chinese political power and sovereignty, and particularly military, along the Tibetan area. I think that back from 1961-62, that's what had raised Indian flags, red flags, in terms of China. I mean, you know the old joke that at first they'd sought to become friends, bye bye, brother, brother, but then after that war, it was bye bye, no more. And then, yeah, and now it's bye bye, B-U-I-B-U-I, because of that trade issue. But even that trade issue is particularly the more hawkish folks in India are concerned that the trade issue is not a source of strength, it's a source of weakness, because it's a deficit. Of that 70 billion, 5 to 10 goes from India to China. The rest is the other way. And I think that the fear of it being adversarial is largely a scar of 1962. Largely a scar, especially along the Tibetan border. I explore that in a chapter, the Indian threat perceptions of China, what the actual logistics would be. I think you'd find that part interesting as based on this question. But I think largely it's a psychological issue. Along the border, it's certainly a psychological issue. But the other challenge is that as China has been extending its presence throughout the Indian Ocean region, just the very fact that there's this very ponderous country, this new entity in the region is enough to raise some red flags. Particularly because it hasn't just been trade issues. It's been Chinese weaponry going to a lot of the countries along the littoral there. It's been an increasing military naval presence. And to Steve's point, even normalization between India and China would not necessarily be friendship. It would still be this competitiveness, even in the military realm. I think that's the case there. Sorry, could you remind me your second point about
India's behavior as a rising power? Is it connecting with the region as China's connecting
yes.
with the
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I do think that is the case. That's certainly its strategy. That's its aim. A lot of the infrastructure that it's developing in Burma was one example of road connectivity that's happening there. Another one is in Bangladesh, where in an effort to access Burma more easily, trade between India and Bangladesh is also easing up. They've slowly been resolving a lot of the border disputes along the India-Bangladesh region, and a lot of analysts are actually saying that in the next few decades, India and Bangladesh will see a more open border along the sort that we see between India and Nepal. And the fact that analysts are talking about it now, But then even looking west into Pakistan, I think the fact that many of those trade corridors would benefit both countries, and in fact would benefit Afghanistan as well. I mean, the pipelines are probably more of a pipe dream for all countries, but I think that's the connectivity in the region is a huge priority for sure.
My name is Group Captain Suleri. I'm Air Attaché at the Embassy of Pakistan, and it's not that we had some serial numbers that after he had to take over, I hope somebody also picks up his hand. But I'll concentrate on the military point of view that you were talking about, shifting of forces, naval forces towards the eastern side, also movement of ground forces or the movement of air forces as such as well. What I know is that on the ground right now, there's nothing like that as we speak. We have 33 airfields all facing the eastern side of Pakistan, the western border of Indian. Indian side, similarly the naval forces still facing the same side, the ground forces also still facing the same side. So certainly if such kind of a movement takes place in due course of time, it certainly would indicate that the Indian threat perception has changed, and certainly it will have a similar kind of effect on Pakistan, but as we speak, I'm afraid it does not, is not happening. I will refer to your slide, which was talking about Strait of Malacca and starting from the east, southeast, going all the way towards the western side, right, discussing the string of pearls of China, and also the uneasiness, what did you say, it said that extremely scared of the Chinese influence all over. And relate that to what right now, from Pakistan's perspective, if there's a road which is going from Chabahar to Afghanistan, you mentioned about a base in Turkmenistan, influence in Afghanistan. And whenever we speak and discuss about it, it's always that Pakistan should not think that it is for Pakistan, it is for other purposes. So don't you think there's a disconnect here, that when we talk, why should India be worried about the similar kind of things being done by China? And why should it be threatening India? And if that be the case, similar kind of thing is happening, being done by the Indians around Pakistan, and that's not a threat. So would you like to compare these?
Yeah, thank you. On the first point about the movement of forces, I would say there is greater movement on the naval end, because there's been any naval enhancement on the Indian side has been on the Eastern Front. It's been at exactly on the eastern seaboard there. It's been at Port Blair. Any expansion is all on the Eastern Front. Whether that means a movement away in the long term, I think just by virtue of the balance of forces, then it will mean that. But again, that'll always come to questions of relative power versus absolute and all that. On the armed force, on the land forces, actually, let's start first on the air. The same argument can be made that most of the acquisition of air force, of airplanes, of combat planes, has been with the intention of the northern border, has been seeking to strengthen the northern border. But to your point about ground forces in particular, I absolutely agree. And there, the very hawkish Indian commentator Bharat Karnad has argued in favor of moving them, of taking them out entirely from Pakistan, along the Pakistani border, and moving them up to China. And he says that the reason that hasn't happened yet is not for want of any strategic change, but just because of bureaucratic vested interests. That within the military, within the Ministry of Defense, there are vested interests that, they control this turf, they control the funding that goes towards that. You defund that, you defund their power. So, if granted, that's bureaucracy is often, the issue. But, and then to your point about India's movement and Pakistani threat perceptions, that's a really good point. I mean, that is what always changes whenever, that's always the security dilemma for one is, it kind of moves one down, it keeps pushing them over. Chinese fears means India's concerns, means Pakistani concerns. Specifically on Chabahar, though, I think the impetus seemed to be, it was developed at a time where the idea of using Pakistan as a transit route was not on the table at all. And yet, there had been memorandum of understandings and energy trade deals that had been signed with the Iranians, with the Turkmens, with the Kazakhs, with the Uzbeks. And yet to access all those resources, transit trade over Pakistan was not a feasible option. If and when Chabahar turns into a naval base for the Indians, then I think you have a very strong case for what you're arguing. But if the focus remains commercial, I think that argument is a little stronger. And if transit trade across Pakistan is really strengthened between Afghanistan or Iran and Iran to India, I think that'll be a whole other question.
Hi, my name is Chen Yang. I teach classes here while working for the federal government. May I ask a hypothetical question here? Okay. We remember that the United States played the China card very well and finally ousted the Soviet Union from the Afghanistan. So which country do you think eventually will play China card if they wish? Pakistan or India? Well, these both countries are on very good terms with China right now. Yeah, Pakistan and China have strategic partnership. Well, the Chinese president has just visited, India. So that's a.
Sir, what did you mean by the China card?
Yeah, play will Pakistan or India or both countries will play the China card?
Sorry, I don't understand the question.
What I mean is eventually who will maintain a more closer relationship with China?
Oh, India or Pakistan. Uh-huh. I see. Yeah, I think that unquestionably it will be Pakistan. There's that rhetorical phrase that both countries always use. Our friendship is higher than the mountains, it's deeper than the oceans, it's sweeter than honey, everything. It comes from a long history of cooperation. And with India seeing China in much more competitive light, I think it's unquestionable that Pakistani relations with China will always be stronger than Indian relations.
My name is Pradeep Rao from the School of Business here. I'm not much of a student of the region, even though I originated there, but I have a question regarding China's interest in helping India and Pakistan detente. Is there any reason why they would want to help in that? And with their own border conflicts with India, how do they see the way to resolve the Kashmir problem, which is really the one name that has not been mentioned all this evening. And I just thought that I would ask you what China's position would be.
Yeah. Again, in the concluding chapter of the book, there's a very, very detailed exploration of how China would play a stronger role in South Asia. And despite all of these competitive relations, I think that China fundamentally, more than anything, more than even military power and the exercise of that military power, needs to expand its economic growth. That's its key goal with regard to all of this. And to ensure that, even China wants a stable South Asia. It doesn't want one that's exploding all the time, figuratively, but also literally. And especially now that as you mentioned, the Chinese president just went to Pakistan to say we're going to be building a road across Pakistan to access the Arabian Sea. If that investment is to go through, and if that is to be a successful investment, they will not want India and Pakistan fighting. So I think to ensure the security and stability of their own economic growth, that's something that they'll seek.
Hi, my name is Angeline Patel. I work at U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. My question is regarding India's interest in stopping the spread of terrorism. I think with Afghanistan being rebuilt in a sense and the U.S. withdrawing its forces and such, I feel like India would be more interested in kind of having influence in Afghanistan, as well as Pakistan wanting influence of more pro-Pakistan Afghan government. Would that not contribute to their rivalry more versus being distracted by China on the other end? How does that balance out?
That's a good question. With regard to, you mean especially as the U.S. is withdrawing?
Right.
There have been a lot of allegations that India has been supporting anti-Pakistani militants in Afghanistan for that very reason. It's even the allegations have been at a very low level. It's been sort of, you know, just here's a cache of weapons, go do what you will, rather than any sort of large-scale strategic support. That said, in the long term, I do think that India's interests with regard to Afghanistan are largely economic. Stabilizing the region is absolutely a big part of that. How that will play out with regard to Pakistan, I'm not exactly sure. But what is very interesting is that 20 years ago, when India and Pakistan had a much stronger, much more overt conflict and rivalry in Afghanistan, what the Indians did was set up an intelligence desk to carry out terrorist attacks in Pakistan, to build up military forces against Pakistan and really handle it in a much more heavy-handed way. But what's very interesting is that after 2008, after terrorism hit Bombay, hit India in a very direct way, the reaction was not a mobilization of troops. It was not counter strikes of any sort. But what did happen was a reorganization of its internal defense and security apparatus. I think that was a smaller part in the bigger discussion about improved governance that's been happening in India right now. And I think that its own concerns over terrorism, particularly domestic terrorism, will be one on that front in terms of domestic governance reform.
Thank you. Chrissy Bishai, also an alumni of the Elliott School and now Department of the Treasury. Quick follow-up on Anjali's question. So, you know, Manmohan Singh was the Prime Minister when Mumbai attacks happened. Obviously, from a different party than the current Prime Minister. How do you think Modi would react? Do you think he would be as restrained, you know, and not be as militaristic in his response were there to be another attack within India by Pakistan?
Yeah, that's a question that really came up a lot, particularly in the run-up to Modi's election, and especially since, and even since then. Particularly because he came from a background of a much more, you know, hawkish, with more hawkish advisors, with more hawkish legacy. But that said, the same argument was made about the last BJP government. It was that they were equally hawkish. They were equally, you know, they would have to respond with the same amount of force. They would have to respond with the same stronger hand than any Congress government would. But in 2002, when that happened, when a terrorist attack did happen in Delhi, the most response was just a buildup of military forces along the Pakistani border over a number of months that didn't actually amount to anything. And that was largely because the India-Pakistan dynamic was operating under a nuclear umbrella. And that remains the case. And I think that has tempered Indian reactions and potential responses to Pakistani terrorism. And no matter who is in charge, I don't think anyone yet would risk. The worry over that, about that nuclear umbrella, is too large.
Yes.
My name is Vinod Pasjit, and I'm from Mauritius. You mentioned the word, you use the term vested interest, and I would like you to consider the role of the vested interest of the Pakistani army, which has, a major say in decision making in Pakistan. How would that play in terms of formulating the Pakistani reaction to your envisaged scenario? If India were to make overtures, what would be the Pakistani response, given the power structure in Pakistan?
Right. There are 2 points about the military, the role of the military within Pakistan. One is that because of Pakistan's own changes in strategic perception, namely its concern with its western border with the United States rather than with India, many of those decisions, of course, they'll still be made at General Army Headquarters. But that strategic shift within Pakistan, a lot of the strongest arguments in favor of a detente are happening in the media, of course. But even the ones that are happening in General Headquarters are a little more pragmatic in terms of what could benefit Pakistan. And when most favored nation status was extended, for example, that was a decision that was okayed by the generals. So I think that because of these more structural shifts in what's happening in South Asia, even if the military infrastructure remained the same in Pakistan, it would benefit from a change. Of course, that's not to say that the Pakistani military will immediately, want peace or friendship with India, but I think the incentive structures are slowly shifting away from that.
Yes?
Hi, my name is Anmir, and I'm a student here in the Elliott School of International Affairs, and first, I just want to say, as a GW alum, your personal inspiration for someone like me who wants to further my studies in advance my studies in South Asia. My question is, and I just got an exam, so I might have missed this. This was part of the presentation. In Pakistan, there's suspicions that of foreign involvement or influence in Balochistan. From an Indian strategic viewpoint, what would India like to happen in Balochistan? Thanks.
Thank you for your kind words. India's Balochistan policy, I think, and perceptions of it have definitely been tainted by a very strong history where Indian intelligence was unequivocally supporting Baluchi separatists from, the 1960s or 70s on. So I understand where that concern is coming from, for sure. But in terms of the medium term, I think there are a couple of schools of thought within India. There still are a handful of hawks that say, we should at least keep those relationships alive that we have with the Baluchis and strengthen them and to help weaken
Pakistan's control over that. But with regard to this broader strategic shift, I would say that it's definitely using the Baluchi card is not as strong in the discourse in India as it once was. Whether that means, I mean, I'm not privy to that intelligence of whether it's being used or not, but it's certainly not as strong a card as it was. And I think even that shift is very noteworthy.
All right, I think we're also out of time.
Well, let me just conclude with a couple of comments, if I may, Neil. One is that, you know, if you look at India and China, the leadership in both countries over the last decade, I think the goal has been actually quite similar, that is to achieve a strong, developed economies. And so in a way, one might see a flip side of what you are arguing, that is the competition between India and China might actually lead to a detente by India with Pakistan. On the other hand, you could get the same result, but different motivations. That is that there is a growing convergence of interest between China and India, that a peaceful periphery is absolutely essential to their own economic development. Therefore, that would still lead to a detente of sorts between the between India and Pakistan. A second point is that, you know, even if you have, and I think we do see this movement where there is the growing prospect that of no real war between India and Pakistan, for lots of some of the reasons that you laid out. For example, the way that India responded to the terrorist attacks, and the fact that I agree with you that I don't see India reacting in any forceful way for a variety of reasons, that itself is actually a fairly big good news. So that would also, you know, the absence of war, while it's not the same as forceful sort of building relationship, it's still a very much a welcome development. But I think what you've done, Neil, is given us a very bold and imaginative way of conceiving relations in South Asia. And as I said, I think it's very aspirational, and it's something that we all hope that comes to pass, one way or the other. So please join me in thanking one of our illustrious alumni from